just one.
Just get over it. We'll try again.
Good evening. Let me invite you to remember a word that I use, that the text presents as something of a set of bookends. Remember, we saw in chapter 1 the word keep. Let me see in the last chapter the word keep. So that shapes my consideration of the whole book. Somehow, what I get from the book is something that I can keep. If I can't keep it, somehow I'm missing the point, because the book is meant to be kept. So I have my official card where I listed my keeps on here that we started. Now, I've actually had to go redo my card after we've added one since then. And I hope you will think about having your own set before we're through. If you want, we can go back and revisit that. But again, this is a frame that the text provides. Blessed are those who keep the word. And then at the end, keep the things written in here. That's what we're supposed to do. So let's do that. Let's just start with our next chapter. Let's read a while. It's a fairly long chapter. So let's see what we find in chapter 14. Let's start there tonight. Chapter 14, we're marching our way through. So I hope to address 14 and 15 tonight. Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their forehead. And I heard a voice from heaven like the roar of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouth no lie was found, for they are blameless. Then I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. And he said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water." Another angel, a second, followed, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all the nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality." And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest, day or night, these worshipers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man, with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, calling him with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe. So he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, the angel who has authority over the fire. And he called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle. Put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, for its grapes are ripe. So the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the grape harvest of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia. Two requests I have over here. First, somebody connect us to a popular song in American history that draws on this passage. Secondly, I'd like you to connect back. What do we hear in this chapter that sounds like something we've heard already in this book in an earlier place? I think the answers are numerous, so you're not trying to guess the one right answer. Just notice for me now. Who will make connections both to popular culture, historical culture, and to this text itself?
The Vatican Republic.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you did. I thought you might just burst into song for us there, Dan. But yes, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, I believe Julia Ward Howe, the writer of that song, a terribly important one, but trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. Right, those are the words from the song. And you can't hear those words without being drawn to this. And I want you to, in some ways, that kind of connection is what we see between this text and the Old Testament. When we see this, we should be hearing things from other places, as we've noticed, say, for example, when the angel tries to measure the temple here in Revelation, we should be reminded of Ezekiel doing the same thing, or maybe not the angel, but the witness. Okay, thank you for that. Another connection inside this text, something we've heard before.
Well, you get 144,000 here, and I think it was chapter 7.
Thank you.
The 144,000.
Yes, and I don't think, I wouldn't want to push this too hard. Remember, the chapter divisions are kind of artificial. Well, not kind of, just plain artificial. But it was chapter 7, and now we're double 7. We're at 14. So, and the book ends with 22, 3 times 7 plus 1. So this is kind of nicely spaced in the book. I think once you've seen some things, the opening of the six seals, we're ready for a seventh chapter 7 vision. And now we've heard three chapters about beasts, and we get another something like chapter 7. In the number that's named here, 144,000 in each place. Now, a difference, of course, the earlier reference listed 12,000 from each tribe. We're not given that, we're just given that number. So it's almost a shorthand reference back to that earlier one, but that's clearly there. I invite you to look for other things somewhat similar in maybe comparing chapter 7 and 14 some more. Any other time, you're not limited to that chapter, but it is a likely source for such comparisons. Anybody?
Marking on the forehead.
There is marking. And notice two kinds of marking. There's a mark for those, mark of the lamb and the mark of the beast, both are talked about. But think about this, when we think about the popular culture or popular attention to this text, it seems like to me there's a lot more attention given to the mark of the beast. Maybe it's more dramatic and exciting, but in the book, there is at least as much attention given to the mark of the lamb as the mark of the beast. So in one sense, that kind of takes away the drama. The mark of the beast, and it says there's a mark. And the way I put it in more our modern parlance, everybody gets a t-shirt. But you're just going to get a t-shirt for the size you're on. All right, thank you for that, the marks. Others?
Great.
Yes?
Well, my song was Don't Fear the Reaper, but that was my song. Classic rock song.
Rock song, Don't Fear the Reaper.
They're singing of a new song.
All right.
They're singing again of the new song, I think, earlier in chapter 6, 5.
Chapter 5, where the lamb is talked about, a new song is mentioned, yes.
Right.
Thank you for that. Thank you. That's important. Let's see. That's in 14:3. They were singing a new song. Notice where they're singing it. Before the throne, and before the four living creatures, and before the elders. So in a sense, we're being taken back to the throne scene of chapters 4 and 5. We're back there again seeing the same things, hearing the same song, or hearing a new song again. All right, thank you for that. Anyone else?
Do you have another one, Randy?
Do I? Well, I can't help think we can find some. You know. But I will suggest to you this pattern that I think we've seen it in chapter 12, we've seen it in chapter 13, and now we're in chapter 14, we see it again. We're not quite at the end of the chapter, it's end of a section. But look at verse 12 with me here in chapter 14. 14 verse 12, I would say one thing I see that I've seen before, I see the word keep again. So I hope by, if nothing else, sheer repetition, you draw a sense of the importance of this word. Here in verse 12, here's a call for the endurance of the saints. Now, I'm going to get two levels. Remember, one, the word endurance is back in chapter 1. I, John, your brother and fellow partaker with you in tribulation and the kingdom and a kingdom. And the patient endurance which are in Jesus. Right, that's verse 9 or 10. And then if you go to the letters to the seven churches, endurance is noted several times. The chapter is the first letter to the church at Ephesus. I think it's three or four times that one letter alone. He commends there. What I know about you is I know you have been keeping endurance. You've been practicing endurance. So here, in a sense, what he's saying is we start the chapter, we have this really, again, we have this array of astonishing visions. You see amazing things. And then it comes back to this kind of a reminder that this is what God wants of you. So in that sense, we're invited way up here to see these grand heavenly visions. And then we're brought down here, you know what to do. This is a call to practice the endurance, and this is a call for the saints to practice endurance. And who are the saints? Right here it tells us. Those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. Two things. Those are the saints. And so I'm reminded, remember, of our central verse, chapter 17, 14. These shall war against the Lamb. And the Lamb shall overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those with him are called and chosen and faithful. Seems to me, we remember that there is a fight. We know who wins and we know he's not alone. This tells us who are the people with him. In 17:14, called, chosen, and faithful. Here, the saints are the ones who keep the commandments and keep their faith in Jesus. Right? No surprise. I think I mentioned this to you before, but I like it so much I have to endure it again. In Micah 6, we're given a famous passage that you know about. And what does God require of you but to do justice, love mercy, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God. And we know that. See, and I would say that's exactly analogous to what we're talking about here. The voice speaking and the minor prophets say, he's told you. You know. You don't have to worry about it. You know. That's, to me, keep the commandments analogously. Now, but let's go back to verses right before that. We see three different steps. What does God want from me, says this voice? Does he want sacrifices? Right? And they're kind of standard sacrifices of animals and other kinds of offerings. Does he want sacrifice? Does he want 10,000 rivers of oil? You see what has happened? The next step is it's exponential. It jumped up orders of magnitude. It's not just a kind of regular, normal sacrifice. It is this extravagantly large sacrifice. Is this what God wants? And then he goes, does he want for me the sacrifice of my first child, the fruit of my loins for the sin of my soul? So three steps, he's getting more and more weird. What does this God want from me? I don't know. And then the voice says, he's told you, oh man, what is good? And what does God require of you? Then gives us the list we know. But I like to fit it in that context to remember that there is this extravagant desperation and then a calm answer. I think we're given extravagant pictures and a calm response. Chapter 12, chapter 13, chapter 14, right in the middle of the book, we have a sense of that. I hope. So I invite you to consider that. Let's go to the reaping here in the second half of the chapter, beginning in verse 14. We remember that the dramatic things were initiated by the Lamb that is worthy. He opens the seal. And who comes forth? The horsemen of the apocalypse. Death and destruction, war, famine and disease. That comes forth and bad things come forth. What we're seeing here is this is God acting in judgment. And that's one of the visions we need to keep. And we're there. We have to keep the visions. One of the visions is the vision of judgment. Clearly it's there. You have to hold that. You have to remember that's part of it. But, of course, we can't be mistaken and only cling to those visions because those are not the only vision. But they are clearly here. Right? That this is, look, it's so conspicuously in verse 14, and this takes us back to another place. Look at this, 14 again. Then I looked, and behold, this is the second, at least the second time we've got a behold in the chapter. A white cloud and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man. Where have we heard that before? One like a son of man. That's language out of Daniel, but it's language out of chapter 1 in Revelation. Because there we're told John sees one like a son of man among the seven churches, among the lampstands representing the seven churches. So the language out of Daniel. Actually, I think Ezekiel uses that language too. The one like unto a son of man is now brought to us. This is Jesus, chapter 1, clearly. And now Jesus is sitting on a cloud with a golden crown and a sickle. And it's time for the harvest. Right? So there is And again, this suggests kind of a harvest of judgment, a harvest of it being open. We're only two-thirds of the way through the book yet. So again, I use this as a claim that we're not trying to trace one story all the way through 22 chapters to get to the end. I'm suggesting we're seeing the same story presented again and again in different ways. Stories of judgment, but not only judgment. We know how the book ends, right? With the water flowing from the river of life, river of the water of life flowing from the throne of God, the tree of life yielding its fruit in every month. Right? That's a picture that's not a picture of judgment, but a picture of celebration, a picture of delighted recovery. In one sense, we're back to the garden, right? The last chapter takes us back to where the book starts. The whole book starts. Okay. But I did want to get that chapter 1 connection, and I appreciate those who pushes back into the Old Testament too to see that. Remember, you could almost say that this whole book is a collection of Old Testament pieces. We just know really one thing, the Lamb overcomes, and then you start decorating with Old Testament references. And you've got the book of Revelation. Again, I'm not trying to discount the nuances. I want to pay attention to those as much as possible. Okay, so there are two harvests here. Harvest of the grain crop, right? It seems. And then the second is the harvest of the grape crop. I don't know what to do with the difference between the two, the angel and the second one. Lots of angels popping up. I'm not sure, this is something I mentioned to you, and I'm not sure what to do with it. I'll have to leave it to you to think about. But remember the structural feature we've had. After the throne scene, we go to seven seals. And then six and an interlude in the seventh seal. But the seventh seal introduces seven trumpets. And so that stretches us out, and we get to the seventh trumpet, you know, at the end of 11 there. So now, where are we? Well, we've got this little series of chapters that have something of a, chapter 14 here has this interlude like chapter 7, but 12 and 13 were about the dragon and the beast, so kind of the centerpiece of the, you know, of the threat of the war. And the word war is used several times in those chapters. Well, now we're going to look ahead at chapter 15 in just a minute. We're at the third set of seven. Seven seals, seven trumpets, and now seven bowls. Seven bowls of wrath, seven plagues that are contained in bowls that are to be poured out. So that's another structural stage that drives us on. And when we get through with that one, then we're just at the closing, where we get back to this language of the, well, let me get to a couple things before I forgot. Let's think about this. Did I miss something? Let's see. Where was the language about Babylon in this chapter? Oh, yeah, back in verse 8. Thank you. Two things. Back in verse 7, and he said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory." I would say you can put that on a list of keeping. In the midst of everything happening, I can keep fearing God. I can keep giving him glory. I don't have to understand everything. I just have to fear. And there again, see, that's another word, just like judgment. See, fear and judgment, love and mercy, you know, we people easily grab hold of two of those, but the other two, but for us, if we want to be full readers of the book and not half readers, we're going to recognize and give place to both. And so we have this keeping again. But again, let's look at verse 8. Another angel, a second follow, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." All right? Remember this, there is no Babylon at this time. Babylon had long disappeared as a city. But it's referred to. And so I would suggest to you that we could think about this as, again, a continuation through the whole Bible, because I do believe you all go all the way back to Genesis and back to Babel. I don't believe that the sounds are accidentally similar. I think there is some connection between Babel and Babylon, the city, historical city. And now Babylon exists not as a historical city, but as this vision, the vision of destruction that some would, that we're going to see later, chapter 17, that some would see this, well, this is Rome. Well, maybe it is, but it's not tied to Rome only. I think maybe, if I were the people reading the book, the first book, the first readers, they'd probably see this as Rome. Us reading over their shoulder could see, yes, it's Rome. But it's not limited to that. We could think of other places, perhaps. But there again, you see, that's that temptation to, as 1 Timothy talks about, wandering off into vain discussion that doesn't get you, ooh, where's Babylon? Which city is Babylon today? Remember, this is one of Jeff's great sermons from about 10 years ago. I know it because I listened to it this summer on the way to New York. And he said this great line, "It's always Babylon out there." That was his line. Great line, worth keeping. Write it down on your card. It's always Babylon. Because I would say that's telling us, just like there's always a fight, the spiritual warfare going on, there's a place that is the foe, and there are people that are the foe, right? So we're not having to look for the Antichrist, that one historical being. First John, the same writer, says lots of Antichrists, right? The chief mark of an Antichrist is what? Denies Jesus. Push it out just a bit further. Denies what about Jesus? That he came in the flesh. That we want to get those two together. That's the mark. According to John, that's the Antichrist, whoever denies that Jesus came in the flesh. Because you see, You see, that's the desire. See, there are a lot of people who tell you Jesus is a great idea. Jesus may be a great teacher. See, they'll say things of good about Jesus, but they don't want to acknowledge that he's God in the flesh. They don't want to acknowledge John chapter 1. Again, the same writer. John chapter 1, verse 14. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And the Greek word there?
Tabernacle.
That's why we want Harold, just for tabernacle. Eskenos, and he tented among us. So in that sense, you see, bringing the language. John uses the language of the Old Testament tabernacle to talk about how Jesus dwelled with us in flesh. Okay. Thank you for that. Let's go ahead and I want to make sure we get our reading in. So let's read chapter 15. And keep thinking about repeated language that we've seen before. Then I saw, repeated language, another sign in heaven, great and amazing, seven angels with seven plagues, which are the last, for with them the wrath of God is finished. See there, even the wrath of God has its end point. And I saw, a second time, I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mingled with fire. Sea of glass, where have we seen that before? Come on, that's right. Chapter 4. And also those who had conquered the beast, there's a word, and its image and the number of its name standing beside the sea of glass with harps of God in their hands. Not plain vanilla harps, but harps of God. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, great and amazing are your deeds, O Lord God the Almighty. Just and true are your ways, O King of the nations, who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name. For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship you, for your righteous acts have been revealed. See, there again, our book is not a mystery. Our book is the revealing of mysteries. And so if you finish the book confused, you didn't read it right. Because it's meant to be a book of revealing. It's meant to be a book of clarifying. A book of seeing. And so, again, our discipline minimalism may help us do that. Then it goes on. Look at verse 5. After this, I looked, and the sanctuary of the tent of witness in heaven was opened. The sanctuary of the tent of witness. That just sounds serious. And out of the sanctuary came the seven angels with the seven plagues, clothed in pure, bright linen with golden sashes around their chests. And one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God, who lives forever and ever. And the sanctuary was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no one could enter the sanctuary until the seven plagues of the seven angels were finished. Short chapter, but what I would call it a resounding chorus, both of two things. What would you say if you divided this, chapter, short chapter, into two parts? What seemed to be the most obvious, conspicuous two segments if we were to slice it in two? What do we get?
Where it says after.
Where is that? Verse 5. Well, break it, slice it out, slice between 4 and 5. If we slice there, what do we get in the first four verses and then in the verses that follow? What are these two parts about, dividing it between 4 and 5? Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree.
First half is where God's delivering his people, or you know, always there, caring for them. Marvelous is God.
Worship.
Yeah. This is certainly the language of God with his people and the response of those people to God. So it is about being those in God's presence and worship, glory to God, and just cataloging the greatness of God. In fact, we might get words of prayers from this language here. So that's the first part then, is God's people And by the way, how are the people? How are God's people named here? Earlier we saw the saints, right? In 14:12, call for the endurance of the saints. But here, who are those? Who are those who are named as kind of in the presence of God here in this sea of glass and the?
Those that were victorious.
All right, thank you. What's your translation? New English. Thank you. Thank you. As you said, but this is in, you're in verse 2, am I right?
Yes.
Those who were victorious, says Dan's version. Mine, those who had conquered.
Victory over the beast.
Victory over the beast. So here we are. Remember, I've suggested to you there are several ways to that you could present, and I think in pretty good faithfulness. Now, obviously, the more full your presentation, the better. But I've suggested 17:14 gives you the whole book. But I've also suggested to you this one word gives you the whole book. Right? It's in there a dozen times at least. And it is a declaration again and again and again. There are people who can overcome, and they do overcome, and they're singing in the presence of God. That's what we can remember, that it's possible to overcome. It needs to be done. And just remains to be that. So now let's go to the second half. What would you label? How would you, if we've got this worshiping crew in the first half, people who have conquered, what do we have in the second half?
Angels taking action.
Angels taking action. Thank you for that wording. And so here we have, see, these things are put together, they're juxtaposed, put right next to each other. And I think you could say this is what the book is doing also. The book is really pairing scenes of glory or scenes of glorifying God are being paired with scenes of judgment. Angels taking action. That's what's going on. Thank you for that. Anyone? Well, let's go back. Let's go to verse 6. It's no accident we have 7. That's our number we've seen, of course. But now, but these 7 angels are clothed in pure, bright linen with golden sashes about their chests.
Back.
We've seen it before.
Yeah. Chapter
2,
I think.
Well, I think it's probably, we could go back and look in the throne scene. It might be in 4 and 5. But we do know this. I think you'll see the golden sash referred to. Somebody check back in chapter 1, toward the end of the chapter where the one like a son of man is described among the 7 churches. And something is said he's got it around his chest, around their chest, around his chest. So it may not be a golden sash, but some mention is made. But we also know this.
Verse 13.
What does it say that for us, please, Yolanda?
And in the midst of the lampstands, one like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash around his chest.
Thank you. So that same language of the sash, the son of man, one like a son of man, has that in chapter 1. These angels have it now. But now this, it mentioned his long garment there. But here there's a mention about the pure, bright linen in chapter 6. And we've certainly seen chapter 7, people in white robes. And remember the people who cry out underneath the altar, how long, O Lord, before you avenge us? They're given a t-shirt, I think. Let's see what's said. How long? I'm in chapter 6 now. Yeah, chapter 6. This is the fifth seal. And some would say, you know, this is about one person writing a commentary about this title, this whole book, The Avenging of the Apostles and Prophets. So he took this scene as kind of a centerpiece. It's about timing. How long? We've seen that before. Now look at this. And then they were each given a white robe. Those who cried out, those who have been martyred, those who have been killed, those who cry out from under the altar, they're given a white robe as well. And so I think this might be one of the gifts given at one of the ends of one of the letters. Everybody might check on that sometime. So I think we see just a lot of white robes. throughout the book, and we know that there's a symbolic significance to that as well. All right? Who's got a question or a comment in the last couple of minutes? If not, I've got a little preview for you, but I'm certainly eager to hear. Come on, Harold, come on.
I can't help but think in the beginning of chapter 14, if anybody studied with Jehovah's Witnesses, the 144,000
right.
reference, and that became really unbelievable real to me. If anyone's ever been to an Easter ceremony that they have on Friday nights before Easter, I witnessed it. I went there, and they passed the Lord's Supper around, and only one person took of it. And I inquired about that. It was the speaker. He said, I'm one of the 144,000.
Okay.
That I can't go to here without remembering
right.
that and
Thank
seeing
you.
That and trying to understand how they get there, especially when you read down later in that passage, those who are victorious, those who have
right.
followed the commandments, and those who have... It's
well,
a crazy concept to try and understand. What number are you? Are you 130? I mean, over all these thousands of years, you're one of those few?
Well, here's the danger now. It may be one that, well, I don't know, it is one anyone can succumb to, and that is a misplaced literalism. There's a time to be literal, and there's a time to not. It takes to not be, and it takes judgment to know which. And here, 144,000 is an important number. But it's not important as a literal number. It's important as some kind, as representative or symbolic of something else. We could talk about that some more. Thank you for that. Thank you for bringing in that. I had known about that number for that group, but I had not heard of that particular occasion and how that could play out. Harold, you were about to.
Yeah, I was just noticing in verse 14 and 6, where you talk about the angel flying directly overhead. With an eternal gospel to proclaim. And we see that word gospel and we're thinking good news. And actually that's what it is. You know, he goes on, you know, the good news for those that were redeemed in the first five verses, it was good news.
Right.
You know, with the proclamation of God's coming in judgment. But there's news that's also good news for the saints that were suffering is that it's not going to be long. God's going to take care of it, and he's going to pour out his wrath on those that are disobedient. You know, and I, the other thing that I noticed in the verse, you know, in verses, I guess verse 4 through 4 and 5, is that he talks about those who have not defiled themselves with women and so forth, and those who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. The Lamb, when we think of the Lamb in the Old Testament, that was sacrifice. So he's saying, you're following the Lamb. You're not just following, you know, alone behind, but you're imitating, you're actually imitating the Lamb in your life now because you're suffering, right? And that's what he goes on to say. They have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits. First fruits is another Old Testament word
right.
that referred to sacrifice. But now we think of Christ as our first fruits, but here it talks about these Christians that were suffering, they were first fruits too, indicating that there's going to be other Christians that are going to suffer after
right.
you, and they're going to be along with you in that. And then finally that last word in verse at the end of verse 5, blameless. If I'm not mistaken, That's the same in the Hebrew in the Old Testament. It's the word that was used to refer to the animal that was brought, had to be without spot and blank, without
blemish.
And the Hebrew word would have been the Greek word for blameless. You know, it's used in the same way. And so he's emphasizing the fact that you're suffering. You're making there is a sacrifice involved with following the Lamb.
All right, thank you. Thank you for bringing in, once again, Old Testament connections. I appreciate it. And also the language of this eternal gospel. And then once he said he has a gospel to proclaim, what words does he say? Fear God and give him glory. In some ways, that is at least related to this eternal gospel. So that gives us some, we might think about that. How are you going to put in the words what the gospel is? We'll talk about that
Ecclesiastes, fear God and keep his commandments.
The last chapter of Ecclesiastes, chapter 12 there. Thank you for that. All right, let's close in prayer. Thank you for your help tonight. Holy God, thank you for your words. Help us see and keep what we see. Thank you for showing us things. Thank you for this good company talking together. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, you know it's hard to call on Harold with a minute to go.